It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the UW system is delaying a free speech survey for students on its campuses. We'll talk to one of the organizers of that survey about what they're trying to measure. First, dairy farmers around the state are coming together to call for changes in milk production regulations in the U.S. Farm Bill. They're calling the proposed legislation the Dairy Revitalization Plan. Members of the Wisconsin Farmers Union and of local Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation groups are working together through the nonprofit Dairy Together. That group is asking Congress to stabilize dairy prices to help slow the loss of family farms. According to Dairy Together, that would mean elevating milk prices, preventing dairy overproduction, and reducing milk price volatility, among other things. Dairy Together is hoping the legislation will be part of the 2023 Farm Bill. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about your life and your livelihood? Are you a dairy farmer yourself, struggling with profitability, or have you gotten out of the dairy business yourself? Whoever you are, wherever you are, do you want to see changes in how milk production is managed in Wisconsin, in the United States? Do you have questions for our guests? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Travis Klinkner is a board member of the Vernon County Farm Bureau and an organic dairy farmer in Wisconsin. Travis, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Darren Von Ruden is the Wisconsin Farmers Union vice president. He also owns an organic dairy in the state. Darren, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Darren, before we get to these proposed changes, let's talk about the problem we hear again and again over the years, a decline in the number of farms in Wisconsin, dairy farms in Wisconsin and elsewhere. What are some of the biggest challenges you're trying to tackle here?
Well, certainly trying to make sure that there's enough income coming back to the farm to make sure that the generation that's farming it today can be there for tomorrow, and then our grandkids and great-grandkids can also have that opportunity. And really the biggest challenge is that income side of the equation. We've continued to fight with below cost production pricing for our products for many years now. And looking at the dairy revitalization plan, I think we found a mechanism that can probably help stem that tide.
Travis, can you talk about maybe what you've experienced or other Farm Bureau members you talk to have experienced when it comes to, you know, what happens when the price of milk drops, but your input costs don't? Maybe they even go up.
Yeah, frustration. That's probably the number one thing most farmers can relate to. As you know, when this happens, and we all can recognize that there is at times an excess of milk on the market. A lot of our cooperatives have put us on at times different type of quotas to actually limit our productions just because they're having a hard time moving that product. And that's kind of what led us to this dairy revitalization plan of finding a way to nationally manage that so that individual co-ops aren't taking on that burden of having to limit its own producers while others who are shipping to an independent dairy creamery or even other cooperatives who don't have some type of limitation on can just keep adding on more milk, contributing sometimes to an already exacerbated problem.
Darren, I know supply management can be a really controversial issue in dairy. There are concerns, you know, if the federal government is setting these strict caps on things. How are you trying to thread that needle with this plan? How are you looking at supply management?
Well, certainly it's the plan that we're looking at is not going to say you can't produce any milk. We certainly have a history of around a 2% growth in the annual needs within the country. So this program hopefully will accommodate some of those concerns. Also, the language that we're using, that's why we're saying dairy growth management versus supply management, because really what we want to do is grow the industry. We don't want to restrict it to something that wouldn't be palatable for farmers across country. Now, of course, we're certainly going to see those folks that don't want to see any restrictions or controls on them whatsoever. We'll fight the plan tooth and nail. But, you know, looking at the future, you know, it's really good for the country as a whole to make sure that we have a very diverse set of dairy producers. And you know, the way we're going, there's going to be fewer and fewer of us on a daily basis. And what we really want to see working within the Dairy Together program is trying to make sure that we have more producers instead of fewer producers.
Travis, I wanted to ask about the process for coming up with this plan. This has been, if I'm understanding correctly, years in the making. Can you talk a little bit about the road to coming up with this plan?
Yeah, this has been a long, long road, and I'm actually jumping in the middle of it. There's been work done by the Holstein Association all the way back in 2009, and they actually came close to getting parts of something like this in the Farm Bill back in 2010 and 14. But they failed at the last minute. And so when my cooperative, Westby Creamery, had put us organic producers on a quota, and I came across the Dairy Together meetings where they had Canadian farmers come in and talk, I was interested. I was intrigued because at that time we were being limited by our co-op, and I wanted to see if there was a different way of how we could have handled that as a co-op. And I walked away just awestruck and with 10,000 times more questions. And so I've dug in deep to this, researching different thoughts, different plans, a lot of discussions from people across the nation, from California to Vermont to, you know, Missouri and Kentucky, you know, and there's a common thread that everyone recognizes there's an oversupply of milk, but it's how do we implement something nationally that's palatable to all sizes of producers, all markets of milk. And like Darren alluded to, we still want the, you know, markets to grow because there is domestic demand growing every year at 2%. But as a industry or dairy farmers, we're actually producing 3 to 3.5% more. So it's 1 and 1.5% excess of milk that we're burdening ourselves with and causing our prices to somewhat suffer because we have to get rid of this product and we're selling it below cost, and that just in turn lowers everything else. So we've come together, we've worked together with a lot of different individuals. You know, myself, a Farm Bureau member, has been working with some farmers union members to strategize because it needs to be industry wide. You know, it's not just one group that's going to move this. There's got to be a general consensus on this to accomplish that. And so we've been working really hard to put together a plan that allows for growth. It's accommodating to large and small farms. It allows for new and beginning farmers to come in. That's one limitation that we hear a lot of, you know, that, well, how is something that's limiting, you know, the growth of milk and you're suppressing, you know, supply, how is a new guy going to get in? And so we've put measures in to allow for that, you know, and we still rely on exports. You know, that's a big part of, you know, us as dairy producers, we rely on exports. And so we don't want something to hinder that also. So we've worked really hard to come up with a plan that we feel accommodates a lot of those big ticket items.
Now, Darren, people might be listening and thinking, hey, I eat cheese, I drink milk. If we're limiting the increase in production from year to year, do I end up paying much more?
Yeah, so Dr. Stevenson and Dr. Nicholson did do some research into that too, and they're looking at, you know, if the plan was implemented, let's say 5 years ago, it might have raised the price of a gallon of milk or a pound of cheese anywhere from 10 to 15 cents. But that also means that the farmer was probably going to be getting another $1.20 to $1.40 per hundredweight for the milk that they produce, which in turn would probably have our numbers of dairy farmers in the state right now over the 10,000 farm mark versus the under 7,000 that we're at. So, you know, implementation, yes, it's going to raise that price, but right now we're seeing more than that raise in price because of our fuel prices and the energy costs that are going into moving dairy products around the country. So, you know, looking at it, is it worth it? I think a lot of consumers I talk to anyway, are willing to spend that extra 10 to 15 cents to make sure that there's more dairy farms left out in the countryside.
We're talking about a farmer-proposed dairy revitalization plan and what the future holds for dairy production. Darren Von Ruden is with the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Travis Klinkner, board member of the Vernon County Farm Bureau. They are working in the process of trying to get this dairy revitalization plan into next year's farm bill. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. If you are a dairy farmer yourself or a former dairy farmer, or you live in a community that relies on it, what do you think of the ideas you're hearing from our guests? Are you on board? Do you have questions? Do you have concerns about this? Do you wonder about the impact on smaller scale farms versus larger scale farms? If you are a consumer of dairy products, what are you wondering about now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with dairy farmers Travis Klinkner and Darren Von Ruden. Travis is with the Vernon County Farm Bureau Board, and Darren is vice president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. They are talking about a dairy revitalization plan, a plan to manage the supply of dairy, hoping to keep prices sustainable for dairy farmers in Wisconsin and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jim is with us in Hollandale. Jim, hi.
Hello. Darren, you know me and I know you. Anyway, the main reason I'm going to continue to lose producers is because the price of milk is controlled by the wrong people. I mean, the federal order system, anyway. The federal order system sets it up so that there are four classes of milk. And in this state, 85% of the milk goes into the cheese vat. So cheese, price per pound of cheese, which when you break it down, it takes 10 pounds of cheese, 10 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of cheese, 100 pounds of milk to make 10 pounds of cheese. The price of cheese is what determines what the milk price is, mostly in the state of Wisconsin's Class 3 milk. But if it gets too high, like it did 2 years ago, when it was $2.80 a pound for cheese, dairy producers should have gotten about $28.00 for their milk. Instead of getting $28.00 for their milk, the federal milk marketing order system, that's what I was trying to think of, reblended the price of all the rest of the classes of milk, fluid, yogurt, and powder, all into one price. So it got the price the dairy farmers got down to $18 a hundred.
Jim, thanks for the call. Darren, is the system weighed against farmers on the price per 100 weight there?
Well, it certainly is. And that's, you know, one of the things that we're looking at, you know, is how do we price that product? This plan is trying to bring stability into the program. You know, we can see swings on a yearly basis of anywhere from $7 to $10 a hundredweight, either up or down. Some years we see it go both ways, and so it's really hard for a farmer to budget on what they're going to spend on products that they need, or are they going to look at maybe a small expansion or an investment in something else off the farm, but. You know, certainly looking at that swing, it's really hard to do that. And something that we want to see with the revitalization plan is to get some more stability in that pricing. And, to really answer the question that Jim was asking, that's something that is controlled by the USDA through the federal order system. It would take an act of Congress to change that pricing mechanism, which is something else that a lot of dairy farmers are talking about right now.
Jim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And both Jim and Darren there, Travis, brought up a really important part of this. It's not just low prices, but volatile prices and how impossible it seems like it would make it to plan for your operation over the next couple of years if you don't know if prices are going to be okay or just bottom out suddenly. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I agree. That's the one thing that we aim to gain by this plan is the reduction of volatility. And that was the one thing that Mark Stevenson and Chuck Nicholson, through their modeling, were able to show is it took a lot of that volatility out of there. You know, and Jim brings up a great point. You know, there's a lot of things I think that need to be fixed with the whole dairy system. And one of them is pricing and how that price is discovered. You know, it doesn't seem fair when cheese is $2.80 and we're not getting that. That's something probably needs to change there. But like Darren said, that requires an act of Congress. And what we're trying to introduce here is just one of the many steps to, you know, improve the dairy system. And the first is to recognize that there's an oversupply of milk. If we can begin to manage that, we can take out some volatility. If there's interest after that to work on finding new ways to price our milk, you know, and determine that price for a more fair price for the farmer, a more fair price to the consumer, and a more fair price to the processor, I'm definitely open to that also.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Terry now in Milton. Terry, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm wondering what's happening to the quality of our milk. With whole milk today, it seems that, to me anyways, that there's no body to the milk anymore. There's no milk fats. It's like 2% milk was a few years back. And I understand that because they can get higher prices for the milk fats, they're putting it somewhere else.
Terry, thanks for the call. Not exactly on our pricing topic, Darren, but you want to take a stab at that? Have the standards for what whole milk is and the way we measure that changed at all?
Yes, it has, and that's been part of the dynamics of the nutrition system that we live in, nutrition titles throughout the country. You know, if we actually would have the California milk standards throughout the country, we would be using more of that or keeping more of that milk fats in the whole milks, the 2% milks, even the 0.5% milk. But over the years, the processors have seen that there's profits to be made in taking those milk fats out of the fluid milk and putting it into cheese, yogurts, butters, you know, all the different products. And so that's why we've seen that reduction. Totally agree. I don't think we have the same flavor in 2% milk today that we had 25, 30 years ago.
Terry, thanks for that call. We're talking about the dairy industry, calls for change in the next farm bill. Darren Von Ruden is with us from the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Travis Klinkner, board member of the Vernon County Farm Bureau. They are both on board with some changes they see needed. Travis, we hear again and again, the number of dairy farms in Wisconsin has gone down. Milk production has gone up. Size an issue, the scale of operations. Is this a plan that helps bigger operations, smaller, medium, more than other sizes?
Yeah, it's a hard to find a program that's probably a one size fits all where everyone's just a winner, winner, chicken dinner. but what we've hoped to have gained here is a plan that allows the opportunity for every size farm to grow, whether you're a 20, 30 cow, 60 cow dairy to 1,000, 10,000 cow dairy. If you decide to grow within your allowable growth, you could be rewarded by receiving some payments back. If you're an individual who's bringing a son or a daughter or a partner on and you want to grow faster, you're still allowed to do that. You may have to pay what we call a market access fee to do that. But we've tried to make that market access fee not a large hindrance to put somebody out of business. We want everyone to succeed. But, you know, if you're growing faster than what the market's demanding, you're going to have to compensate for that versus the guy who's going to stay within his lane and stay where he's at. You know, and it's been a challenge because the industry isn't growing like it was, you know, 40 some years ago where a guy brought his son on and, you know, they maybe added 5 or 10 cows. That's these farms in, you know, these other states like Colorado and Idaho and Michigan and Texas, where they're not just adding 10 to 100 cows, they're adding tens of thousands of cows. And they're the ones that are in some ways creating more of these issues. And so we're trying to put in a plan in place that they can still do that if they want. But those of us that stay within our lanes, we're not going to get hurt as badly by them doing that.
Now, Darren, you're working on a big, complicated thing, dairy regulation, in the midst of one of the biggest, most complicated bills Congress does on a regular basis, the U.S. Farm Bill, with lots of moving parts. How are you hoping to see this, you know, this movement you've gotten from local farmers, from different groups and different sizes and things like that? How are you hoping to get that on the political map in next year's Farm Bill negotiations?
Well, it's truly an uphill battle, but everything in this country tends to start at the bottom and work its way up. We've got quite a few years of experience at working this program now under our belt, and we're certainly hoping that it'll catch the attention of our elected officials. But being at the early stages of the Farm Bill is really important. If we came in at the 23rd hour of the 24-hour Farm Bill process, we probably won't get much attention. But being we're in the beginning stages of Farm Bill debate and having this conversation today amongst farm organizations and farmers themselves certainly should bring the spotlight to the need for some revitalization within the dairy industry.
And Travis, just briefly, if a dairy farmer is listening, wants to learn more about what you're trying to do, how can they check it out?
If they can go to dairymarkets.org, Mark and Chuck Stevenson's website, through the UW system, they have a calculator there, or maybe an easier way to get to it would be to go to the Dairy Together website. And I know they have a link there where you can actually put your own production numbers in as a producer and see how, if this plan would have been implemented back in 2014, you can play around with it and see how it would have affected you. The one thing I would advise producers to do if you're a dairy farmer looking into this is look at it in a different way. You know, we've typically gone, when you see a farm expand, it's an expansion from 60 cows to 300 to 400 cows, you know, overnight. With this type of plan, if you're going to try and, you know, for lack of better words, beat the system, you may want to look at, you know, growing in smaller steps.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Travis Klinkner with the Vernon County Farm Bureau, Darren Von Ruden with the Wisconsin Farmers Union, looking at a call for new dairy regulations in the U.S. Farm Bill. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a filmmaker whose latest documentary looks at religious architecture around the United States, including here in Wisconsin. Now, the UW system was planning to survey students this spring at its campuses about how they feel about their freedom of speech and expression. Last week, that survey was postponed until the fall after some questions were raised about how it was going to be put into effect, and UW-Whitewater Interim Chancellor Jim Henderson resigned in part as a result. The topic of free speech on college campuses is hotly contested around the country, and organizers of the UW survey say it's important to collect data on the issue to inform policy decisions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the UW system survey its students about freedom of speech and freedom of expression? Have you checked out the survey questions that are out there? What do you think? If you work on a campus, if you're a student on a campus, are these hot topics for you right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Timothy Shields, a professor of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. He's director of the Menard Center for the Study of Institutions and Innovation, the organization planning to lead the free speech survey in conjunction with other academic groups in the state. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Rob. Thanks for having me on the show.
Can you talk about the origins for this survey, first of all?
I can, but to do that, I have to take you back about 30 years.
Sure.
That's how long I've been a free speech scholar doing free speech research. So this wasn't something that just popped out of thin air on a whim. I have done a First Amendment survey of Wisconsin citizens some years ago, too. So, again, just didn't pop out of thin air. The reason it happened right now is I've been thinking about doing something like this for a couple of years, and I didn't have the funding available. Some of our projects for this year, in part due to COVID didn't come through. So I found myself with extra funding, and I had met people recently that would be good partners in this. So it was the right time to do it.
And when I say survey, I mean, this isn't exactly the sort of public opinion survey people might be used to seeing. I think this is coming from kind of an academic angle. Can you talk about what you're trying to find out and how you're trying to find it out?
Sure. So many people are probably familiar with the controversies about here. You know, so some people think there's not enough viewpoint diversity on campus. Some people think that's fine. Some people think students are staying quiet because they're afraid of professors indoctrinating them, and other people think that's not a problem. And right now it's just all speculation, really. And so, the point of the survey is let's try to get some data. Like any survey, it's just a snapshot. It's not the end of the story. It's sort of the start of more research. We could find out more about what's going on.
There's a concern. I think you mentioned there's controversy. I think there's a concern that, there are a lot of questions on here. People from anywhere on the political spectrum are likely to take one or two of those questions and use them as a political cudgel. Do you worry about how, even whatever your intent here, how the results could be politicized?
No. 30 years doing free speech, you can't do this and not run into controversies. You can't run into people who want to turn things to fit their own agenda. What we're hoping, though, is that when people discuss free speech after the survey, they'll have some data points they have to refer back to. They won't be able to just, blindly talk past them based on anecdotes or personal biases or assumptions.
Now, if this had gone ahead as scheduled, I believe it was last week, if someone's a UW student on any campus, what would they have seen? How would they have been approached? What would be in their hands to fill out?
They would have gotten an email from some office on campus. I think there were some variations on campuses who was sending the email, but somebody from their campus, maybe the dean of students, maybe the registrar, would have sent an email with blanket basic introduction to the email, to the survey, and a Qualtrics link. That link would have taken them into the survey then. It would have had the usual kind of, consent language, and then students could have proceeded to share their perceptions.
And then, of course, the question is, it didn't happen last week. What is your read, or what led you to postpone this to the fall?
Really, it's simple. There just were too many questions to answer in too short an order for it to launch on time. We want to be as transparent as possible. We want to be as upfront with people as possible. There's some legitimate questions being asked. There's no point in trying to force it without people really understanding what's going on. So, I really appreciate this opportunity to try to share a broader message about the survey.
Talking to Timothy Scheel, professor of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Stout, creator of this free speech survey scheduled to go out last week to students at UW campuses around the state, postponed now till the fall. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, what you would want to know from a survey like this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rose is with us in Menominee Falls. Rose, hello.
Hi there. I have no objection whatsoever to doing a valid study and collecting the kind of data that the guest is talking about. However, it reeks of political theater when it's spent and bought and paid for by a very well-known political entity. And so it right off the bat, it taints the whole validity of the study as far as I'm concerned. And if they really want good, real data, they should commission it from the university itself.
Rose, thanks for the call. Rose raising questions about the funding of the survey, pointing toward the Menard Center. I think people have talked about it being funded by somebody who leans, it's fair to say, conservative. What do you say to address those concerns, Timothy?
Well, two things. It is System doing it. The Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service is a unit of UW System, and they're the ones actually conducting the survey. Mm-hmm. The funding, well, we have the name Menard, but we're not a spokesperson for the Menard's point of view. We're an academic center, and we have academic freedom. I don't ask for their approval on any of the projects I do. I've had no correspondence with them whatsoever about this survey. It's my research area. I wanted to pursue it. I am.
Rose, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. You know, I am so tired of the right complaining about not getting their free speech rights when I couldn't possibly get a left point of view on any AM radio station in the city. Free speech is only supposed to be for people on the right, and the people on the left are just supposed to be quiet. Thank you for listening.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Tim, you are focusing on campuses in particular, not the general media and opinion landscape. Can you talk about, as you said, you've been at this for a while, talk about the importance of free speech issues on campuses in particular?
Well, first, I guess I want to back up and say free speech isn't for any particular side. The whole point of free speech is free speech for we, not free speech for me. So on campuses, there's some concern. We don't know whether it's legitimate or not about the left sort of having control of the conversation. Off campus, there's concern about the right having control of the conversation. All that's outside of our control. We simply want to collect data to try to get some idea of what's actually going on. Again, it's just a snapshot. It's just one survey. One survey doesn't prove anything. It's a starting point for a more informed conversation.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I read through the questions, Tim. It covers a lot of ground. What are some of the things you're most interested to hear about to maybe frame, as you say, frame future research?
Well, several things. So one of the things our survey done that isn't often done, or I'm not sure if it's ever been done, is we have a little section asking what knowledge of the First Amendment students have, because we're interested in part in that on its own merits, you know, how much do they understand about their own rights, but we also are curious whether that has any correlation to their perceptions of the free speech situation on campus, to their views about viewpoint diversity on campus, and to their perceptions of self-censorship on campus.
We're talking about a planned free speech survey on UW campuses with one of the organizers, Tim Scheel, director of the Menard Center for the Study of Institutions and Innovation at UW-Stout, where he is a philosophy professor. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. The study, as we've mentioned, the survey was delayed until the fall. Are you hoping it ends up going forward? What are you hoping to learn from it? Are you a college student, a parent thereof, or do you work on a campus? What do you think about free speech on college campuses? Do you think that students are generally able to freely express their opinions or viewpoints? Do you have questions for our guest about the survey and what we're hoping to get out of it? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our talk with UW-Stout Professor Tim Scheel. He is the organizer of a free speech survey for students on all UW system campuses, scheduled to be released last week, postponed now until the fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you hoping this survey goes forward in the fall? What do you want to know about what students are experiencing when it comes to, and thinking for that matter, when it comes to freedom of expression and freedom of speech on campuses? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Gene in Wales. Gene, hi.
How you doing? I was concerned. I got on the web and I read the whole survey, and you know, first of all, it's coming from a part of the university that an agency that was initially started with the Koch brothers' money and now Menard's money. So we have some interesting dynamics going on there. But what bothered me was when the students would have been done with this anonymous survey, they needed to say or was suggested, like, which party are you involved with, and some demographic data about the person filling out the form. And then it was the beginning of the survey said that only five people or the people on the top of this form would be the only people looking at this data that would be generated from this survey. So I'm concerned that this becomes a database that somebody else could use down the road.
I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Tim, did you want to, before getting into his main question, did you want to tackle what he brought up about funding?
I would encourage you, if you are worried about our hidden agenda or something, that you go to our website at the uwstout.csii and look at our actual programming, look at what we actually fund, and you'll see there's no hidden conservative, there's no overt conservative bias. We're a legitimate standard academic center. We bring in speakers and do research all across the political spectrum.
And Gene's main point, though, was asking about confidentiality of the data, how the demographic parts of your survey are going to be used.
Yeah, so the survey, like all these surveys, is anonymous. No students will have any identifiable information that will be available to anybody. In fact, I won't even see any of it. Our lead designer will erase all of that before we look at the data. Doesn't strike me as any more of a concern with this survey than any other survey that's done anonymously.
Gene, thanks for the call. Will you be able to do, I know often in survey research there are the cross tabs, so you could say students who identified as Democrats were more likely to think this versus Republicans and so on. Will you be able to use the demographic data in that way?
So that's the point of having the demographic data. You know, is there a difference between males and females or people who have a different sexual identity? Are there differences between people of different political identities? Are there differences between, you know, that's what you have the demographic data for. So it's routine, standard sorts of questions. It isn't at all unusual to ask about that if it has relevance to the subject.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I just was wondering if anybody had caught the irony here that a survey is being delayed for fear of what it's going to say.
We lost your connection, Mark. Started off great, got muffled. Our producer says the summary, Mark sees it ironic that a survey on free speech is being delayed over concerns about how it will be received. I'd asked earlier, Tim, about how it might be used as a political football there. Do you see that as ironic in some ways, as I think Mark was saying?
Well, I guess I do, too. Wisconsin University System is famous for its sifting and winnowing plaque, the fearless exploration in the search of truth. And it seems like being fearful in the search of truth is preoccupying some people.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Sorry we lost the connection there, Mark. Tim joins us now in New Berlin. Tim, hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm interested because your guest seems to be awfully concerned about free speech on campus, but on the grade school and high school campuses around the state, there's a great deal of attack on free speech. A lot of school boards want to get rid of To Kill a Mockingbird. They want to get rid of Harry Potter. They already have in Wisconsin on campuses. They've gotten rid of books in grade school about climate change. They've eliminated them in some school districts.
Tim, thanks for the call. I know Tim, guest Tim, you've got to focus on one thing. Would you be interested in comparable research on those other campuses our caller was talking about, high school and grade school?
My expertise is at the campus level. But I will say I have concerns about those so-called book bans as well. I mean, as a free speech advocate, unless there's some compelling reason to withhold information from students, libraries shouldn't be withholding books.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Tim Scheel, professor of philosophy at UW-Stout, looking at a survey he is organizing for UW System students on issues of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and how it works on their campuses. Scheduled for last week, delayed now until the fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Tim, sometimes when we talk about freedom of speech and expression, we talk about, you know, specific bans or official retaliation for kinds of speech. There are also concerns about more, I guess, climate of speech issues. Does a student feel comfortable airing their views in a particular situation, whether that's a classroom or campus event or that sort of thing? Can you talk about how you try to measure those things in the survey?
Yeah, actually, this is one of the, I think, innovations of this survey. In many surveys, they ask the question whether and how often students self-censored, but they don't ask why. So it's one of the things we wanted to try to improve on in this one. So we've got a variety of scenarios in which we're trying to get at the reasons why students self-censor. There's lots of reasons why people maybe don't speak up in class. A lot of those reasons aren't anything to be worried or concerned about. There's only really a very few reasons to be worried about that. So that's what we want to try to tease out in the data. Are they self-censoring for reasons that are concern us, or are they self-censoring for reasons that really aren't really anybody's concern?
Now, I know that at least one Republican state lawmaker expressed concern about the delay, saying, well, hold on, if it's the fall, you're going to be surveying some students who maybe only been there for a couple few weeks at this point. Is a fall survey, do you think, going to be less potentially useful than the originally planned spring survey?
Spring would have been better, for sure. We're talking about what would be a good launch time. In the fall, because obviously you're not going to ask campus climate questions of somebody who's brand new to campus climate. Maybe we would have to go with only having upper class students, you know, not asking the new students. So that's a question the research team will have to consider very carefully.
Now, I know there's been some reluctance from some, it seems, leadership on various campuses around the state, some faculty to going ahead with the survey. What would you say to your academic colleagues in particular to make the case that, this is something that ought to happen?
Well, I guess you have the choice of policymakers making decisions based on some kind of data or making decisions based on no data. Currently, it's no data. So as an academic, I'm hopeful other academics would like decisions to be based on some data.
What is the road ahead for this survey now? There's been some hullabaloo about this already. A lot could happen between now and the fall. What are your steps? What's your timeline to trying to advance this thing and make it happen in the fall?
That's a hard question to answer. Right now, we're in conversations with system, we're in conversations with the research team, we're in conversations with faculty across the state and students. You know, it'll take a couple weeks at least to plot the right path forward.
And outside of the survey, Tim, I know free speech and freedom of expression are issues that are near and dear to your heart. What are you hoping people are thinking about on college campuses between now and this survey when it comes to a respect for freedom of speech?
Well, you know, it's often been said it's not human nature to appreciate free speech. You know, we tend to believe we're right and the other person is wrong, and they're so wrong. They shouldn't be allowed to spread their false views. So it's you're asking for people's better nature to accept the idea that they should tolerate ideas they disagree with, ideas they find maybe very offensive. It's not an easy step for us all to make, but that's the step we need to make, especially at a university campus. There's going to be research that you don't like. There's going to be conclusions researchers reach that you may not like. But that's the sifting and winnowing promise of the UW system. We gather the evidence, we sift and winnow it, and it's all part of the continuing attempt to get closer to the truth.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Timothy Scheel is professor of philosophy at University of Wisconsin-Stout, director of the Bernard Center for the Study of Institutions and Innovation. He was with us today to share more about the UW system's delayed free speech survey. He's helping to organize and implement on college campuses around the state, originally scheduled for last week, now scheduled for the fall. Here's a fun conversation coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Our sense of smell still has a lot of mysteries. Check out the latest science behind the scent. That's tomorrow at 8:30 here on the Ideas Network. What's the most popular kind of pet in every state? Easy, it's going to be dog or cat, right? But what if you leave out the cats and dogs? What's the next most popular pet? Google Trends has their answer to that question, though I'm kind of skeptical. They went state by state using search requests for different kinds of pets. Here in Wisconsin, our number one non-canine, non-feline pet by that standard is the guinea pig. Okay, maybe Michigan agrees with us on that. Our other three neighbors, Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, all pick chinchilla. All right. And like the entire southeastern part of the country says, bearded dragon. Like that's a common lizard pet, but really? Also, I noticed something missing from all of these, bird and fish. Now, maybe if you want bird, you don't search bird. You search Norwegian blue parrot, lovely plumage, or whatever specific bird you want. Same with fish. Also not showing up at the top of the list in any state, ferrets. Happy National Pet Day. This is Central Time.